right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Good evening, it's 5:03 and it's time for a full hour of independent news. Today we've prepared a special program for you on oil tankers in BC's coastal waters and the implications of increased oil tanker traffic in Burrard Inlet. We'll be bringing you an interview with the Deputy Managing Director of the International Association of Independent Tanker Owners and a live discussion with Ben West of the Wilderness Committee and Mitchell Anderson, a reporter with the TIE, who has covered the issue extensively. That's in the second half of the show.
And in more local news, we'll be bringing you coverage of the ongoing series Food and Beers at the Museum of Vancouver. Last Thursday's panel discussion, moderated by TIE editor David Beers, focused on food security in the Vancouver region with the question posed to panelists, can Vancouver feed itself? We will bring you highlights from that discussion.
All this plus your arts report and weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent, local, national, and international news.
But first, the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Nell Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Officials in Myanmar, also known as Burma, announced today they will not allow foreign observers to oversee upcoming elections scheduled for November 7. The nation's election commission also said that international media will be denied entry into the country, despite the current regime's claim that the polling will usher in democracy after 50 years of military rule. The American Bankers Association is holding a five-day conference in Boston. Yesterday, hundreds rallied outside demanding a moratorium on foreclosures. Chuck Rosina reports.
Banks get bailed out, people get thrown out.
As the bankers met inside, hundreds marched to the Heinz Convention Center.
We're not going to let the bankers do this anymore and then welcome them into our city with open arms, are we, guys?
No!
Are we afraid of the bankers?
That was Melanie Griffin, a tenant activist with City Life Vita Urbana, a bilingual housing rights organization who sponsored this rally. City Life has also held vigils and even blockades at homes where people are facing evictions. Grace Ross has been active at the state level fighting foreclosures.
We have to ask ourselves what it means to have a society when they've even admitted that they engaged in tens of thousands of fraudulent documents so that they could take people's homes away. The real question has to be, why is there no accountability when they've even admitted what they did?
The protesters were not allowed on the grounds of the Heinz Convention Center. Police claimed it was private property, even the sidewalks. A number of major lenders recently moved to stop pending foreclosures across the country after questionable processing practices were revealed. But many more homeowners still face the prospect of losing their homes to lending institutions both large and small. Chuck Rosina, Free Speech Radio News, Boston.
A Category 5 super typhoon pummeled the northern Philippines today, with top winds clocked at 165 miles per hour. At least one person is dead. Authorities were proactive in emergency management, delivering relief in advance. Power supplies and telephone lines are out in most of at least two provinces, and officials are concerned about the region's rice crops. Typhoon Meggy is now headed toward Vietnam, where 32 people have already died from floods in recent days. Heavy rains in Haiti caused floods over the weekend that killed 12 people, including two children who died in a mudslide at a post-earthquake temporary housing camp. And in East Africa, more floods. According to the UN, in Benin, water now covers two-thirds of the entire country. 100,000 people are homeless. At least 800 have cholera. Thousands of Congolese women took to the streets yesterday to demand an end to mass rapes. The African nation's first lady led the march. According to the UN, at least 15,000 people were raped in eastern Congo last year alone. 303 were sexually assaulted in just 4 days this summer. The Institute of Race Relations published a report today that blames racist policies in the UK for the deaths of 77 migrants over the last 5 years. The most recent, Jimmy Mubenga, died during deportation just last week. Naomi Fowler reports.
The nature of these deaths varies. According to the report, a third of people suspected or known to have taken their own lives after their asylum claims had been turned down. Seven died after being denied health care for preventable medical problems. Another seven died in prison custody, and 15 died during highly risky attempts to enter the UK. Others were the victims of racist attacks or died working illegally in dangerous jobs. The Institute of Race Relations estimates the number of deaths of asylum seekers now averages one a month. Naomi Fowler, FSRN, London.
The U.S. Supreme Court said today that they will decide if former Attorney General John Ashcroft has immunity from prosecution for broad detentions of Muslim men following the 9/11 attacks. A lower court ruled that Ashcroft can be sued for the material witness detentions, but the White House has asked the High Court to overrule. Abdullah Al-Kid sued Ashcroft. He was picked up at Dulles Airport in 2003 as he headed to study in Saudi Arabia. Al-Kid was held for 15 days in what his counsel calls a gross misuse of power. As Election Day draws near, campaign ads abound. In both Iowa and Nevada, candidates have employed controversial ad campaigns that some call blatantly racist. And in New Orleans, one such advertising tactic has community leaders outraged. Zoe Sullivan has more.
Civic leaders representing a broad array of groups in New Orleans gathered this morning to condemn a campaign ad for incumbent Senator David Vitter and called for its removal. Vitter's ad caricatures Latino immigrants. It depicts a group of Latino men cutting through a chain-link fence to be welcomed with a large check while border officials stand helplessly by. The men climb into a limo and drive off waving the check. Lucas Diaz, the director of Puentes, a community organization in New Orleans serving Latinos, feels others should be disturbed by the ad's racist implications.
I think anybody who belongs to any group that's disenfranchised, that's a minority group, that sees something like this can easily think, well, that could be us. It could be the gay lesbian community, it could be the black community, it could be the Jewish community, it could be the Arabic community, and on and on and on. So, you know, that he just chose one group of people is unfortunate, but if it can happen to us and no one says anything, it could happen to any other group.
Zoe Sullivan, FSRN, New Orleans.
For Free Speech Radio News from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
And thanks, as always, to Free Speech Radio News for providing us with those headlines. You can find their full newscast and the daily headlines at their website at fsrn.org. And now we go to our weekly feature with Colleen Kimmett of thetie.ca. And Colleen's on the line with me to talk about an article that she has just published on the online news magazine, thetie.ca, on the issue of food security. And Colleen, thanks for being with me.
You're welcome.
So tell me a little bit about this article and what you found. I know we talked a while back about the article you were writing, and now we get a chance to check up and see where that's at.
Yeah, the article was based on a panel discussion that the Tie hosted, co-hosted at the Museum of Vancouver on Thursday night. And we invited four people representing four different links in the local food chain. So we had restaurateur Niru Dalwala, co-owner of Vidja's Restaurant. We had Ian Walker, founder and president of Left Coast Naturals, which is a snack food distributor. Lori Stahlbrand from Ontario, who's the founder and president of Local Food Plus. They're trying to get more local food into large public institutions, like the University of Toronto, for example. And the fourth was Amy Robertson, chair of the Farmers Market Society and a former farmer herself. And so we asked the participants to throw in their ingredients for a healthy local food economy. One of the points that came up first and that came up throughout the evening was that people aren't used to paying very much for food in North America, and so it's hard to especially when...
Are you there, Colleen?
Costs are cheaper.
Are you there, Colleen?
Yeah, hi.
Okay, you were just cutting out briefly, so if you wanted just to cover that last sentence again, I think we missed out on that.
Well, one of the first things that came up was they all agreed that people don't place a high value on food in North America.
Right.
We're used to getting it cheap. And so that's one of the challenges that we face in building a local food economy is trying to inform consumers about the real cost of food, what it actually costs to grow it.
How do you do that?
Well, one of the ways, I mean, education and outreach for sure. One of the proposals was to build a food hub, and actually local food activists in Vancouver are working on doing this, building a hub that would not only serve as a permanent farmers market and distribution hub for local food, but it would also be a community kitchen, a place where people could come and, you know, learn the ins and outs of farming, how to process local food, canning workshops, and things like that. Amy Robertson also pointed out that these types of programs are really effective in schools.
Mm-hmm.
She pointed to the UBC Farm Summer Camp and Children's Garden as good models to replicate because children are really keen to get out in the dirt and to learn more about food and gardening and growing.
This almost sounds like going back to food collectives and cooperatives where people do come together and they share space and that food production is possible in a space, and it's also a way to build community in larger urban centers, I would imagine.
Yeah, and the cooperative idea came up also in terms of helping farmers and food processors achieve economies of scale. For example, Ian Walker of Left Coast Naturals said that it's a big investment to shell out the capital costs of food processing infrastructure, so maybe that's freezing or drying or canning, and that when you're a small operator, you're not producing enough volume in to be able to spend the money up front. And so he suggested maybe processors could get together, invest collectively, and then share it. Maybe you're doing, I don't know, tomatoes on Monday or peaches on Tuesday. Some kind of a cooperative collective model like that.
And do you think in many ways, Toronto, I know we covered this before, but you felt like Toronto was ahead of Vancouver in terms of increasing food security in the metropolitan, the GTA?
Yeah, and I think I actually spoke to an audience member after the panel who said that he worked for a restaurant in Toronto buying local food, and he found that there was a better distribution network. There were more small-scale distributors, so they would buy wholesale from farmers and then redistribute it to restaurants or smaller markets in the city. He said that was an advantage because it meant you could quickly get an idea of market prices without having to have relationships with a whole bunch of individual farmers. So instead of calling 10 beef producers and asking, you know, what are you charging for a pound of beef right now, you could talk to one or two distributors and get a sense of what the market for beef is.
Now, do you think food distributors, obviously there are some that are very into working to address issues of food security, but do you think on a whole there is going to be some opposition from distributors?
Well, I think it really depends on the distributor. I mean, certainly I'd say the whole food economy works on pretty tight margins, and so everyone is trying to keep their own costs low. And that goes all the way down the food chain until you get to the farmer who isn't really getting much at all. But I think that I think that some distributors who have those values, I know Discovery Organics is one of the better ones in the city, who are willing to be more flexible with small-scale farmers and willing to work with those farmers because, you know, philosophically they want to support local food and because there's increasing consumer demand for local.
Really, really interesting. We've actually got more coverage of this very issue later on the show. We had one of our reporters at the Food and Beers panel discussion last Thursday, so definitely going to be talking a bit more about that later in the show. But just to give people the name of that article again, where they can find it, what is it, Colleen?
It's 10 Ingredients for a Healthy Local Food Economy.
Okay.
And I'm going to be expanding on some of those 10 ingredients in a series we're launching next week on the Tai'i, so you can look for it, those articles as well.
Great. Well, we are looking forward to it, and thank you again for joining us on News 101.
Okay, you're welcome.
Okay, take care, Colleen.
Bye.
And that was Colleen Kimmett from a reporter with the Tai'i.ca, just published an article talking about food security, and always appreciate checking in with her. We're going to go to Jess Landing and Iqbal Ahmed for News 101 headlines.
I'm Jess Landing.
And I'm Iqbal Ahmed, bringing you the News 101 headlines. In campus news, the Alma Mater Society is in the middle of its campaign to convince Metro Vancouver that rapid transit to UBC should be made a regional priority. Through the use of social media and the website ubclinenow.com, the AMS has been encouraging students to directly contact Metro Vancouver and show their support for rapid transit. The AMS contends that UBC's large commuter population and the congestion along the Broadway corridor warrant such a system. Although neighborhood associations oppose rapid transit as they fear the disturbances and high costs that would accompany the project, as was the case with the Canada Line. The deadline to submit public comments to Metro Vancouver is October 22nd.
Today, Chris Delaney, lead organizer of Fight HST, announced that even though it's been 3 weeks since Project MLA Survivor Recall, Vote Them Off the Island launched, the race has become red hot with over 2,000 canvassers having already signed up province-wide. As of earlier today, Oak Bay Gordon Head's MLA, Ida Chong, stood at the forefront with 178 canvassers, while MLA Donna Barnett of Caribou Chilcotin and Kamloops North MLA Terry Lake followed in second and third, respectively. Delaney attributes such a high level of volunteer interest, especially in Caribou Chilcotin, which doubled its numbers, to the fact, as he says, quote, "The people there are very upset with their MLA and are determined to be among the first to launch a recall under Fight HST," end quote. However, the contest is not over. With still 4 weeks remaining, there is plenty of room for change, and with the current level of volunteer interest, Delaney believes that the new year will bring quite surprising, will be quite surprising for a number of Liberal MLAs in BC.
In local news, Solar Home, a partnership between the City of Vancouver, Solar BC, Tourism Gas, and Offsetters, has announced a $4,300 incentive program for Vancouver homeowners to install a solar hot water system. The subsidy, which would cover roughly 50% of a system, is aimed at producing green jobs, building demand for solar systems in the residential market, and promoting the viability of such a system in Vancouver's rainy climate. The incentive program is available until December 31st, and certain eligibility requirements apply.
Thank you to Jess Landing and Iqbal Ahmed for producing the News 101 headlines for today. Now we go to our coverage of the ongoing series Food and Beers at the Museum of Vancouver. Last Thursday's panel discussion, moderated by Tai'i editor David Beers, focused on food security in the Vancouver region. We go to News 101 reporter Megan Tercato for this report.
We've all heard about the benefits of locally grown, organically produced agriculture. No pesticides means we're not putting chemicals into our bodies or our earth. Shorter transportation distances means a reduction in the use of fossil fuels. Local production means increased food security. The list goes on and on. But most of the food we eat here in Vancouver is not local or organic. A panel of experts convened at the Museum of Vancouver last week to discuss why and what can be done to shift our diets to a more local, more sustainable options. One of the major themes of the night was money. People want things at the lowest possible price, and this includes food. As Ian Walker explains, much of our food is subsidized, and this means we don't pay the real price of our food.
Well, I mean, if you go to a grocery store, try to find a product that doesn't have corn or soy in it. It's pretty difficult to do, and those are two fairly heavily subsidized crops that are selling well below the cost of what it actually is to grow them. When you start bringing in the extra costs, such as the damage to the environment, and I'm not even including those, but...
So you're subsidizing food when you allow it to be farmed unsustainably. You're subsidizing food when you allow it to be...
When it's sold for under what the true cost is.
The panel discussed how this unwillingness to pay the true cost of our food has led to some strange incentives for farmers. For example, some farmers reported being forced to let produce rot on the vine or in the fields because the cost of paying workers to harvest it would be more than they could get for it. On a global scale, Laurie Stahlbrand showed how price incentives can lead to redundant trade.
We are exporting as much as we're importing, and often the very same products. So we are exporting apples and we're importing apples. We're exporting carrots and importing. We're doing this on every product you can name just about. And it's a terrible waste. It makes no sense. And it's terribly bad on the environment. So it's all driven by individual corporations making decisions about what is going to work for them as a corporation, but it doesn't take into effect because the cost of fuel is so cheap. They're paying so little for it, they don't have to take it into their calculations at all. If we were paying for the true cost, the externalities, we weren't externalizing all the costs, none of these things would be able to happen. So the apple situation is China is growing apples, producing, and they're very cheap. And they're largely very cheap also because the workers are paid very little. So apart from the cost of fuel to transport them here, they're also undercutting our apples because the farm workers are paid so little. So what they do is they export their apples and they bring them to the West Coast. So then in Washington, big apple producer, Washington now has apples that are from China that are undercutting their apples. So what do? They export their apples to the East. And in Ontario, we have a big apple producer, Norfolk Fruit Growers Association. It's one of the oldest co-ops. It's been around for more than 100 years. They were one of the first to come on with Local Food Plus. And they would like to be selling in Ontario, but they're now being undercut by Washington apples. So they go to Europe. And in Europe, Tony Blair makes an announcement that British school children are going to have more fruit and veg in their school meal program. And Norfolk Fruit Growers wins the contract to provide apples to British school children. Meanwhile, the British apple growers are pulling out their apple trees because they have nowhere to ship them to. So we need to be pushing this right back through the system. And what we're trying to do is open up new markets for the Norfolk fruit growers so that they don't have to be taking these contracts in other parts of the world, and they can be selling their apples in Ontario, and the Washington apple producers can be selling them in Washington.
Restaurateur Miro Dhaliwal posited that in order to get people to be willing to pay more for the benefits that local organically grown food provides, we need to tackle what she calls the Rock and Republic blue jean mentality. Here is Dhaliwal and Walker having a rather humorous exchange about the apparent unwillingness of many people to pay the real cost of their food.
I've been doing a lot of research for our packaged food as well, and this is one thing I noticed is whether I go to Save On Foods, let's just do Save On Foods right now, I went there and I actually followed the people around just to see like what they were buying. And I was doing my own marketing. I was doing my own marketing research, right? And I'll tell you one thing which we've got to tap into somehow in terms of education, and I don't mean to sound tacky about this. There are a lot of people there who are wearing Rock and Republic blue jeans. Okay, Rock and Republic blue jeans, if you go to the store on Granville Street, I actually then went to find out the Rock and Republic blue jeans because they were quite popular at Save On Foods. They're $300. And so what we've got to figure out is these women who are wearing $300 blue jeans are literally picking the cheapest food possible that they can find in the produce and the freezer section of the grocery store.
This is the issue that I have. A lot of people saying food is too expensive, but when we first started, we made products and we sold them at a day table at Granville Island. That was how the business started. And we sold an organic nut butter for, I think it was about $7 or $8. And we had, so the number of people that came up to the counter
and said, this is way too expensive, and they were holding a $5 Starbucks. I mean, it's a very typical story, but I saw it happen countless times. They had a jar that would last them probably a month or two worth of organic almond butter, the nutrition aspect to it, and the coffee was $5, and there's no correlation.
As several in the audience were quick to point out, there are also many people in Vancouver who truly can't afford to pay more for food. Stallbrand argued that this cannot come off the backs of farmers.
Farmers are among the impoverished in our society. Rural poverty is very real. Most farmers are not making a decent living, and the reason why we're losing farmers and losing farmland is because farmers cannot make a living. The average age of farmers in Canada is 55, and very few young people are going into farming at this point. So we always work with the food security organizations, and we say, we need a good social safety net. We need a fair minimum wage. We need proper old age pension so that people can afford to buy food at the price that it is worth.
Many ingredients to create a market for local, sustainable food were suggested. Panelists wanted to see government institutions using their buying power and committing to buying local and organic products, marketing boards to help local producers get their products onto local store shelves, and a streamlined system of organic certification to keep bureaucratic costs down. In the end, the big word of the night was education. The consumers needed to be educated as to why local organic food was important, because every time we buy food, we all vote with our dollars. I'll leave you with Laurie Stallbrand explaining how even shifting $10 a week of your grocery budget to sustainable local products can make a big difference.
What we're asking people to do is to shift $10 a week of what they're buying currently. So it's not adding $10 to your budget, it's shifting $10 a week. And it's true that the food may cost a bit more, but on average we would say that the food of the farmers are producing in the Certified Local Sustainable program are maybe on average about 10% higher. So if you're shifting $10 a week, 10% of that is $1. So we're asking you to basically spend a dollar a week to make a real difference in the economy and in the environment and in your society. So if you shift $10 a week from conventional, distant conventional food to local and sustainable food, if 10,000 people in BC were to do that, and we've made these calculations specifically for BC, if 10,000 people were to do that in 1 year, you would have offset enough GHGs to be the equivalent of taking 400 cars off the road for good. And you would have pumped enough new money into the local economy to have created 100 new jobs. And that's just 10,000 people in a province of multiple millions. And that is in 1 year. And if that same 10,000 people and not one person more continue to do that in year two, it would be another 400 cars off the road and another 100 jobs with that same 10,000. So imagine if we could galvanize so it's not 10,000, but tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands and millions of people doing that. Talk about stimulating our farmers to grow food for these people. Talk about creating relationships between urban and rural. Talk about transformative change.
Thanks to Megan Turcato for preparing that report. On Sunday, the BD Biodiversity Museum here on the UBC campus opened its doors. We go to News 101 reporter Iqbal Ahmed for this report.
On October 17th, I visited the BD Biodiversity Museum for its grand opening celebration. Located on UBC's main mall and easily recognized by its hanging blue whale skeleton, the BD Museum is free for UBC students and houses over 20 square feet of exhibits and specimens. Hi, if you can just please introduce yourself and tell us about the whale specimen here at the museum.
My name is Bob DeRoos. I am the father of the fellow who did the articulation of this whale. And it is one of the largest specimens. Well, it is the largest whale specimen in Canada. It's totally unique in that it's the only specimen that is hanging with an internalized structure and an open jaw.
How did the whale arrive at the museum? What's the story behind it?
Well, this whale was washed ashore in Prince Edward Island in 1987. When it was dragged ashore and buried in the Prince Edward Island red clay, where it stayed until 2007. When we went and had a look to see what was left, we found everything, and we ended up digging it up, shipping the bones to Victoria, where they were cleaned, repaired, and put back together in sections, and then eventually shipped over to UBC here and put together and hung up for this display.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, sir. Hi, can you please introduce yourself and just tell us why you're here today?
Sure. My name is Colin Morton. I actually live on campus, work down at Triumph at the bottom end of campus. And we've been watching the museum be built over the course of the last year, and then this summer with the Blue Whale in the with the Blue Whale up in the atrium upstairs, and we made it one of the preview events and just decided that with it opening, we thought we would come take a look and support these things, because museums like this are really cool. It's a chance to see a lot of things that you really wouldn't get to see otherwise.
Great. Are you happy with the outcome, what the museum has turned into? Are you very impressed with it?
I am so far. I mean, we've just only walked through about half of it, but it's not what I was expecting. Even from the preview, you really couldn't see what was behind that first row of storage. And walking now through the stacks area of it, it's really neat. They've got a lot of things on display that I hadn't expected.
Is there one highlight of the museum that especially stood out for you?
Well, so far, not really. I mean, we're still finding our way through it. The whale, obviously, is awesome to stand under and look up at. But just some of the displays, even some of the taxidermy displays and things like that, are absolutely spectacular. There's a huge, huge collection of stuff here that I don't think most people knew even existed if they were outside of the department. So.
Great. Thank you. To learn more about the BD Biodiversity Museum itself, I spoke to Museum Director Wayne Madison.
I'm Wayne Madison. I'm the director of the BD Biodiversity Museum, and I'm a researcher who studies spider evolution.
Great. Can you tell us more about the museum itself?
The BD Biodiversity Museum started off by the activities of the biodiversity researchers at UBC starting to gather natural history collections and archive biodiversity about 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then we've recently pulled together into a single facility and gone public. So we're now a public museum with the goal of telling everybody about how cool biodiversity is, the stories of biodiversity, the research that's been done here at UBC, and just all the amazing specimens we have.
Great. How would you define biodiversity, and why do you feel it's important that the public knows about it?
Yeah. Biodiversity is the whole spectrum of living organisms, all the different species, as well as extinct ones. So everything alive that ever has been. It's also the set of interconnections among them, so the ecological interconnections, how they're dependent upon one another, as well as the genetic interconnections, their place in the grand evolutionary tree of life. And it's really important that those who know about this and who have resources to tell the stories do, because if we can make the public understand biodiversity, as well as appreciate it, so that they take it in their hearts, we can do a much more intelligent job as a society of taking care of it.
Great. And can you tell us more about the collection here in the museum?
So the natural history collections here at UBC, which used to be hidden away in various rooms and are now in our central facility, were gathered over about 100 years, and they total now about 2 million specimens. The most famous, of course, is the blue whale skeleton that you can see from Main Mall. But we have 1,999,999, more or less, others that are pretty impressive. The largest collections, the ones that stand as being pretty impressive for a museum of our size, are the herbarium, which is a major one for Western Canada, the fish collection, which is quite an impressively large collection. The insect collection is quite important, and we also have important specimens among the tetrapods, that is to say the terrestrial vertebrates, mammals and reptiles and birds and so forth, and the marine invertebrates, as well as the fossils. Good. So it's quite a spectrum of different organisms represented.
Out of all these different collections, what would be your favorite part of the museum?
Well, of course, the blue whale's great. I really love the little exhibit of 19th century specimens among the tetrapods that sort of show how they used to be presented in the 19th century, as well as some of our smaller scale displays, which are like small, almost blog post style displays with a specimen and a little story. And some of those are just like works of art. They're just really beautiful.
Great. And are there any special programs that we can expect in the months and years to come with the museum?
Oh, boy, we've got so many ideas. We'll see which ones show up. We'll have interpreters in-house to explain things. We've got a lot of programs in design for school kids. But we also want to put together some programs that really engage the undergrads here at UBC, not only in learning about biodiversity, but also participating in our program of outreach for the public. And one thing that's coming up on the calendar soon is November 18th, we're going to have the world-renowned landscape architect Cornelia Oberlander talk about her work. So we're not just simply focusing on science, but also different aspects of how people interact with biodiversity.
Okay, great. Thank you for your time, sir.
Thanks.
Thank you, Iqbal, for that report. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us for our special coverage on oil tanker traffic in BC's coastal waters. We will explore this issue in depth with our live guests. Stay with us.
A video of the incident was posted on YouTube.
Until now, Canada's internet has been an open network and a level playing field for free speech and innovation. All that is under threat. A handful of companies want to limit what you can access on the internet. In May, SaveOurNet.ca led a successful campaign pushing net neutrality to the top of the Liberal Party website. Now, both the New Democratic Party and the Liberals have official policies supporting net neutrality. In addition to that, the CRTC has recently issued new rules intending to prevent the actions of some internet service providers from limiting certain types of traffic and content on the web. But the battle does not end there. To tell the government that net neutrality is a vital part of our democratic society, and for more information, visit www.saveournet.ca. This message is brought to you by SaveOurNet.ca and CITR 101.9 FM.
Entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to Big Pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so Big Pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education. Every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots global unembedded international independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Jess Landing.
And I'm Andrew Longhurst. You're hearing us on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. We're online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. Thanks for being with us. It's 5:41 and time for your weekday weather forecast. For that, we go to Daniel Casanova.
Thanks, Andrew. Well, we'll be getting a few days of sun before the gloomy weather rolls in for the weekend. Expect daytime temperatures to be in the low teens for this week. For tonight, we'll have cloudy periods with a low of 9 degrees overnight. For Tuesday, it will be partly cloudy in the morning, clearing with only high clouds in the afternoon. High of 15 degrees, low of 7. On Wednesday, it will be sunny with a high of 16 degrees and a low of 8. For Thursday, it will be sunny again with a high of 14, low of 7 degrees. Starting on Friday, expect periods of rain with a high of 13 degrees and a low of 8. On Saturday, rain with a high of 13, low of 8 again. And finally for Sunday, rain with a high of 11 and a low of 8 degrees. Currently, it is 12 degrees and cloudy at YVR. The normal temperatures for this time of year are a maximum of 13 and a low of 6 degrees. That's your weather this week, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Daniel Casanova.
Thanks, as always, to Daniel for bringing us that weekday weather forecast and to the Storm Club of UBC. Now it's time for your arts report, and for that we go to Adam Janusz. You can tune in to the arts report on Wednesdays at 5 o'clock.
A documentary about El Salvador's troubled recent history is having a premiere screening tonight.
Return to El Salvador profiles the struggles of Salvadorans during and after the civil war that ended in 1992. Here is an excerpt from the film, talking about how various rebel groups came together to fight the right-wing government and giving an introduction to some of the people profiled in the film.
Five revolutionary organizations merged into the FMLN, a guerrilla army designed to overtake the Salvadoran government by force. Because of the coalition's ties to Marxism, the United States government became directly involved out of the Cold War mentality that necessitated the support of any anti-communist regime. At the peak of the fighting, the United States was sending over $1 million a day in military aid to the right-wing government of El Salvador. By the time peace accords were signed in 1992, more than 70,000 civilians had been killed by their own army. This film chronicles the many legacies of this armed conflict. You will meet a Salvadoran couple who fled death threats in the 1980s, finding asylum and a political platform in the United States. You will meet another couple who returned to El Salvador after the war to work with churches and poor communities. You will hear the story of a heroic environmentalist named Marcelo Rivera, who was kidnapped or disappeared by a death squad just days before the filming of this documentary. And you will meet human rights officials who work diligently to record the violations that occur every day in this tragic and beautiful country.
Que corazón, mi corazón.
The screening is tonight at 8 p.m. at Empire Granville Theater and will include a Q&A after the film with Jose Figueroa, a refugee facing deportation by the Canadian government. For News 101, I'm Adam Janusz.
And thanks as always to Adam for preparing that arts report. You can check out the arts report and tune in on at 5 o'clock on Wednesdays from 5 to 6. That's with Adam. And you can also stream online at citr.ca. It's an issue that many argue is one of the most significant environmental threats to Vancouver and BC's coast. We are taking the next about 15 minutes. Unfortunately, we don't have half an hour, but we're going to explore the issue of oil tankers in BC's coastal waters. The number of oil tankers traveling in BC's coastal waters has jumped nearly 50% in only 2 years, and just last year, there were 65 tanker loads moving through Burrard Inlet. It is an issue on more and more people's minds. This summer, Vancouver City Council held a special council meeting to discuss the issue, which has now asked Metro Vancouver to evaluate this. And environmental groups warn that the question is not if a spill will occur, but when. But while environmentalists see this as a major problem, industry is confident that adequate measures have been taken to prevent a spill. Ben West from the Wilderness Committee is on the line with me now. And Ben, thank you so much for taking the time to join me on the show.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So just a little bit about the Wilderness Committee for those who aren't familiar. What is the Wilderness Committee and what does it stand for?
Sure. Well, the Wilderness Committee is a nonprofit organization founded 30 years ago right here in Vancouver. And it's we're basically a research and education-based organization that works on a variety of different campaigns ranging from wilderness preservation, species protection, to issues like climate change and toxins, which is what I focus on.
And now the Wilderness Committee was one of several environmental groups that was taking part in sponsoring a flotilla send-off and no tanks event yesterday. Can you tell me a little bit about that event and why everyone was out there?
Sure. Well, I guess really to tell you the story of how this event happened, it really starts with a guy named Bill Gannon, who is an accountant who many years ago was involved in Greenpeace activities like in the 1970s, or I guess early 80s. And Bill now is an accountant with an office in Cole Harbor, and he was sitting there one day and he saw a tanker floating by passing his window. And he, like many people, thought there was a moratorium on oil tankers off the coast of British Columbia. And he was surprised to see this large oil tanker that he sort of recognized from his sort of awareness of oil tanker issues. And so he started doing some digging, and he couldn't get any answers from the federal government, from the Port Authority. It was actually a Statistics Canada report that he was able to get his hands on that showed the volume of oil that was being exported drastically increasing in 2007, and this was 2007 when he saw the tanker. And, you know, so about a year later, I guess he kind of was able to piece together what had taken place and basically found out that an environmental review process had quietly taken place. The public was never involved. There was no opportunity for public input. From further digging later, we've actually realized that out of the 25 people on this panel that were making the decision, only three of them were mariners. So the rest were basically industry insiders. You know, so he was quite concerned. He had discovered that basically, very quietly, this group had approved these oil tankers that are but three times the size of what was spilled by the Exxon Valdez to move through the very shallow and very narrow Burrard Inlet. You know, so he started to try to raise awareness about this issue. Bill contacted a guy named Rex Weiler, who's one of the founders of Greenpeace, and a journalist who wrote the book called Greenpeace. And Rex also was concerned, and he reached out to us at the Wilderness Committee, as well as to the folks who are at Greenpeace Canada today. And we started having meetings, and, you know, they started out literally like kitchen table kind of meetings in somebody's house or at a bar, you know, and then kind of from there progressed to bigger and bigger meetings, public information sessions where we kind of built the group bigger, and then we came up with this idea to hold a big event in Vancouver. The first and foremost, the intent of the event was to just make sure that people knew that this was taking place. You know, most people, when you talk to them, don't even know that these oil tankers are out there. So we kind of, first things first, just wanted to get this issue out on the table. We wanted people to know that there was a threat from oil tankers, you know, right now as we speak. And, you know, many people, especially because of the BP oil spill, are quite concerned about these issues right now. So I think it came as quite a surprise to a lot of Vancouverites to find out that this is taking place.
Well, last week I had the opportunity to speak with Joe Angelo. He's the deputy managing director of InterTanko, the International Association of Independent Tanker Owners. And I reached him in Singapore, and he had some thoughts on the issue, and specifically in the context of Vancouver and oil tankers traveling in Burrard Inlet. And so I wanted to play a short clip. This is about 2 minutes long, of his comments on the issue. And I asked him a number of questions about whether Vancouver's port is suitable for oil tankers to be traveling through it, and what the risks associated with that are. So let's take a listen, and then I want to chat with you after that. Is there merit to an argument that is often made that, you know, ports like Vancouver are just not set up to deal with tanker traffic? I know at when the tankers do come through, it's at highest tide, and there's less than 2 meters between the water under the keel. There's 2 meters of water under the keel. Is this a problem, or is this a reason for concern, or is this something that can be managed?
Oh, definitely, it's something that can be managed. In fact, I would simply say to you that there are other places in the world, in particular, ships going into certain places in the United States, in particular down around the in the Gulf area, where 2 meters is a luxury.
Okay.
Okay. So, but see, this is the point I'm trying to make. That I think if the people that are serious about wanted to properly address tanker safety, look at what's happening in the rest of the world, and I'd be more than happy to help in looking at these areas. They'll find there's other areas that are dealing with these situations in a very risk management way that have been very productive.
Okay. And so, and also, some environmental groups have called for an outright ban on tanker traffic in Vancouver's Burrard Inlet. How would you respond to somebody calling, how would you respond to someone that's calling for a ban like that?
Yeah, and I've said this earlier, InterTanko is not going to get involved in the politics, and it's purely, as I see, politics of banning tankers from this area or any other area in Canada. That's up to Canada and the Canadian people. I would just suggest that anybody that is looking to ban tankers, if they're really serious about wanting to improve the safety in the area and tanker improvement, they should take a look at all the other options that are available and how traffic is dealt with in a safe manner in other places of the world where the transportation of tankers can be done safely without pollution in a manner that addresses the risk management appropriately.
So, Ben, after listening to that, what are your initial thoughts?
Well, I've had this conversation with him personally. He was in Vancouver at the speaking at the Chamber of Commerce, and had the chance to sort of hear directly from him sort of what his thoughts about all this was. And I think basically what sums it up from my perspective is basically what he says. He says, you know, he's not weighing into the public policy issues. His job is to try to improve the safety of tanker traffic as much as possible. So, I mean, given his role, I think he's sincere in what he's trying to accomplish. And I don't doubt that his organization is actually improving tanker safety. Moving to double-hull tankers, across the board is a big step in the right direction. If they can actually pull that off, that's great. But the larger issue is, what is an acceptable risk for the west coast of Canada? And I personally think that, what we have is a rare jewel. It's a very, very distinct and biologically diverse ecosystem, that is something very special and I think needs to be protected. Now, at the end of the day, these kinds of decisions need to be made in a democracy by the general public, and the lack of public oversight of this issue is really just simply unacceptable. But to take that a step further, what really is fundamentally motivating me to get involved in this issue is, beyond the immediate threat of an oil spill locally, is as a climate change activist, I just simply don't see any acceptable way to increase the amount of production of oil from the tar sands and the export of that to the emerging markets around the world. As we're supposed to be phasing out the need for fossil fuels, it's just fundamentally irresponsible to ramp up that production. So, regardless of, if we can make these things safer, reduce the risk, and there's nobody's going to tell you that there isn't a risk. The best anybody in this industry can do is say, we'll do the most we can to reduce the risk. People who tell you there is no risk, like BP in the Gulf, turn out to be not telling you the truth. And I think, to his credit, this gentleman has actually not said that. He just talks about the reduction of a risk. Ultimately, when we're talking about what's acceptable risk, that's one issue. But then there's this larger issue of, should we be facilitating the expansion of the tar sands?
And I guess maybe one of his comments was, he didn't explicitly state this, but I don't want to give our listeners a wrong impression if I'm getting the gist of what he was saying wrong, but it's not fair to be pointing fingers at someone like Intertanko, which is an association representing oil tanker owners, because, largely this is a decision that needs to be made by governments, and those decisions can only be made by those governments, and really, as he says, they're not going to wait, they're not going to enter into this political discussion.
Well, I mean, I find that comment interesting, because nobody's pointed the finger at Intertanko. In fact, I'd never even heard of them until they came to town to talk about the issue. So, it's easy to say, don't point the finger at us. We're not here to weigh in on the politics. But when you show up and travel, long distances to come and speak to the issue, it's hard not to critique what's being said. Really what I said to him when I had the chance to talk to him was, are you out there lobbying against climate change legislation? Are you out there trying to stop people like myself from reducing the dependence on fossil fuels? And he told me that they don't. So taking him at his word, I really don't have much of an issue with what they're doing. I think as long as he's being fair and honest about, what the risks are and what they're doing to try to reduce risks. And, of course, there's really, really busy harbors, many places where there's huge risks and there's often spills. I mean, that's why we're concerned. And if you can reduce the number of spills, that's a good thing. But at the end of the day, we're really not just talking about, how safe you can carry oil around. We're talking about, how much oil should we be burning on the planet and how can we get away from that? So ultimately my issue isn't with, the tanker owners. They're just trying to provide a service that in the current reality with the current policies that are out there is acceptable to be doing, but I personally don't think that can continue to be the case, because that perception of what's acceptable needs to change.
Do you have confidence that Metro Vancouver will deal with this issue appropriately?
Well, I think, like many people, most local politicians were surprised to find out that this is even taking place. Most of the conversations that we've had with people, like the city of Vancouver, was, okay, well, we need to dig into this. And to their credit, they held a public forum to, actually get the people on the record, from the Port Authority and from the federal government, actually explaining, well, okay, what's the current situation, what's going on, what's the risk, who cleans it up. And, I think that was exactly what needs to happen. I'm hoping that not only our local politicians at the regional level, but also our federal politicians will, really get this information out into the public. There's a plan to actually expand from 2 tankers a week to 10. We'd like to see a ban, but first and foremost, before anybody even talks about an expansion, we really need this to be something that happens in a public context, because this is a serious issue.
Well, we can leave it at that. Do you have any final comments before I let you go, Ben?
Just that if people want more information or if they'd like to weigh in on the issue themselves, at our website, wildernesscommittee.org/tankers, we've got a campaign page set up and the ability for you to join a list that'll keep you informed, as well as an immediate opportunity to write a letter to elected officials. So if people want to kind of dig more into this issue or get more of the background information, our publication is online there at wildernesscommittee.org/tankers.
Okay, well, great. Thanks so much, Ben. Yeah. I look forward to talking with you in the future.
Sounds good.
Take care now. And that was Ben West. He is with the Wilderness Committee, an environmental group, and talking with me about oil tanker traffic in BC's coastal waters, and specifically in Vancouver's Burrard Inlet.
And that's our program for October 18th, 2010. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, give us a hot news tip, please contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email us at news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITRNews. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news, join us Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Jess Landing.
And I'm Andrew Longhurst.
From the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Career Fast Track at 6 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.